LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and today we present part two of our interview with Courtney Brown, in which we discuss the results of a remote viewing project which focused on the events of 9/11. The interview resumes as we discuss how unlikely it is that regular military or intelligence personnel, never mind members of the general public, would be aware of the existence of exotic types of explosives, advanced secret weapons programs, or other covert technologies such as uninterruptible autopilot, which could have been used as part of the 9/11 attacks. With regards to the uninterruptible autopilot, or the types of explosives that might be available for use, or different types of weapons, I mean, the idea that a regular military guy, never mind some armchair pundit who thinks he's got 9/11 worked out, the idea that the likes of you and I would know all about these technologies that are available, I mean, history tells us that there are these things that get developed quite often. You know, the military uses are at the forefront of new technology, and eventually some of it comes down to the rest of us. But so the idea that there's no such type of explosive exists, it couldn't be done. You know, well, what do we know? And I say, what does even a regular guy in the army know about that sort of level? I mean, it's not going to know about it at all.
Yeah, they don't really, common people don't know these things. But, you know, you can remind them a little bit. For example, with the idea of a very small nuke, if that was, well, one of the things that was used to help bring down and vaporize the World Trade Center. You know, the small nuke idea is actually useful because there would have been, if there were a lot of explosives used to bring it down, there would have been forensic evidence of that all over the place. And the small nuke at the base would have vaporized that evidence. So you would have, and that's what we saw. We saw the huge, you remember the huge clouds when the buildings actually collapsed at the bottom, there was this huge cloud. The buildings were gone. It was like they were shot with a phaser beam from a Star Trek movie. I mean, it was like they were vanished and all you see was this dust. And so the real question is, how in the world, where did the buildings go?
You look at the size, you used to point out the size of those buildings. And
there would have been a huge pile, many stories high.
Yeah, and there would have been a lot of office furniture. God help us, there would have been a lot of bodies.
Everything, and it was all vaporized. Mm. So, I mean, there was some rubble at the bottom, some beams and stuff like that. There was liquid steel flowing. I mean, nothing made sense. But, you know, with a small nuke, for example, most people say, how could it be a nuke? They think of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They don't understand the modern advances that have been done with nuclear weaponry. But then you sort of point out that, you know, those small nukes have been around for a long while, even the dirty ones. And you point out the hydrogen bomb. How do you think that was ignited in the first place? They used a small nuke. The small nuke triggers the big one. And then, but those early ones were very dirty, and they produced a huge amount of radiation. But they fixed that. they know how to do that thing now. And so they have these little small suitcase size nuclear weapons that, for example, if those things are so radioactive, how could they be carried around in suitcases? I mean, you know, I mean, literally, there is some level of radiation, but not a lot. The amount of advancements that have happened with nuclear weaponry is unbelievable. And again, we're not claiming that any one type of explosive was used, but the remote viewing data does indicate that explosives were used. Now, in the documentary, that especially the short 15-minute film that's available on YouTube, hosted by Ed Asner, in association with Architects and Engineers, that group, that video mentions, for example, with the Building 7, which is the third building in the World Trade Center, and it also collapsed, that with that building, it so clearly demonstrated all the physical characteristics of a controlled demolition that if a controlled demolition was used, that that has to be set up a long time in advance, like weeks in advance. You just can't run in and demolish a building just like that in a few hours. You have to carefully set the explosives. You have to wire them. There's a lot of work, a lot of prep that has to go into doing it. And it was a perfect job of demolition. It came down just exactly right on its own footprint. And that would indicate that the buildings were wired for demolition long before the planes hit the Twin Towers. So that's, you know, another sort of weird thing. And you have a bunch of people who are expert demolition people, and they run major companies for demolitions. A lot of architects, engineers on film as well, saying, you know, that was a controlled demolition, and describing what would be needed to do it. And then to say that the demolition was done, if it was a demolition, on the day of the attacks, with the building on fire and the chaos of the Twin Towers right next door, it becomes laughable. I mean, you can't send people in to wire all that stuff the day of the building, the day of the attacks, when all the chaos is going on and the building is on fire. You have to be calm, collected, and get it all right. It takes a couple weeks. Anyway, that's in the Ed Asner doc, you know, 15-minute thing that's available widely on YouTube. And it's a very fascinating set of people. And, you know, and the number of prestigious people from generals on down who have been talking about the crazy stuff and how the official story just simply is crazy. This is really a great time for this remote viewing documentary to come out, because this adds the final piece of the puzzle, which is how it actually happened. All that was happened before was forensic evidence indicate that the official story is bonkers. But no one actually spelled out exactly how it happened, what the groups were like, who did it, where it was controlled, the whole thing, until this one. This is the first documentary that sort of fills in the picture. Okay, the forensic evidence clearly said that the official story was bonkers, but what actually did happen? And this is the first one where all of it is explained from under the best of conditions, with the best viewers and a perfect, squeaky clean scientific design. And anyway, so this is really interesting.
You mentioned earlier about there being one of the sessions emerged an illustration, sort of like a police, sort of a likeness when they get a drawing of someone that they're looking for.
It's actually a painting done on a Wacom tablet by Dick Allgaier, where he took his original sketch, and then while he was still blind to the target, he didn't know anything about what the target was. He just painted it in and made a good picture of sort of one of the very top guys in charge of the entire operation.
Well, it's quite eerie, really, because Dick describes what this guy is like, even that he's got a slight scent of cologne, the sort of clothes that he wears, a great deal of detail. And one of the most interesting sections in the whole thing for me is when Dick and Daz are both looking at this hierarchy of groups. You know, this is answering the question who, and to some extent why, and you've got a pattern emerges of these compartmentalized cells. And of course, what we do know in the real world, when these sort of things are exposed, it tends to be exactly that sort of structure.
Yeah, and Daz is a graphics artist by profession in Britain, and he came up with that really great graphic while he was still totally blind to the target, describing, you know, the different groups. I mean, really well drawn. Describing the different groups, their organization, they're connected, who's connected to what, how many people were in each one, what each group did. It's fascinating. Who were the people in the vans going in to plant the explosives? Who were the people organizing? Who were the people at the top? And then Dick came in with the counterpart of that, with even a really great painting of the guy at the top. The level of detail is... This actually shows you what can be done with remote viewing in the best of conditions. I mean, if anyone had any wonder, like, how far can you take this? With this documentary, you clearly can say, oh, I see. So this is what it's all about.
Dick gets into a fascinating section where he's sketching out some locations. And there's one in particular where he seems to identify what looks like a military base and within it a command and control center, almost like a live air traffic control room. And this would be a location like an Iron Mountain type sort of place, I'm guessing. But the level of detail he goes into, and again, that kind of fits with some of the more well thought out alternative theories about, you know, yeah. what it would have taken to happen, you know, to make events go the way they did on 9/11. However, I've seen yeah. very little until your documentary, very little speculation or information about exactly what sort of organization, where they operated out of, how they, you know, a lot of detail about how this could have been done.
Yeah, yeah, this was, he described it very clearly. He described it as like an NSA facility. And again, the level of detail was amazing. Actually, this was one of the first projects that we've ever had over, until and since the late 1970s, in which we encountered, he described in that particular facility that they were shielding all over the place. I mean, electronic, visual shielding, every type of shielding you can imagine. And this was the first project where we actually found remote viewing blocking going on in a long time. We haven't encountered that since the late 1970s. So they actually tried to put in remote viewing blocking as well as shielding for everything. And when we encountered that in the beginning of the study, I was so delighted because I said, oh, wow, we're really onto something, that means. Because we can recognize when that happens. And we have ways around it. So I simply, when I saw that that was going on, I instituted the anti-blocking stuff and I cleared it up immediately. But the point is, we haven't actually experienced that since the late 1970s. And that was sort of really exciting. You can sort of think of us as like teenage computer hackers, sort of trying to get into remote systems. And when these little challenges happen on the way, it was like, wow, this is fun. This is great. So anyway, it was sort of that was a fun type of a thing. But yeah, the shielding was all over the place. Every type of imaginable shielding. Now, the other thing is, Greg, some people in your audience may be interested in this. You know, I don't know how widespread this project is going to spread in terms of how many people in the world will actually watch it. But it doesn't really matter because governments all over the world do take what we do seriously. They know that the remote viewing is real, whether the mainstream physicists have fully accepted it or not. The governments, a lot of governments are, you know, very aware of all of this. And they take all of, and they know that we're the biggest venue, civilian venue for public studies anywhere. And so, you know, you can be absolutely guaranteed that governments all over the world have watched these documentaries, you know, really closely. And so, you know, they're not going to have any trouble believing this stuff at all. So while some people in the public may say, oh my gosh, could it be real? The reality is the secrets are out now. And, you know, major governments all over the world now know the whole story. I mean, these two documentaries tell the whole story. So anyway, at least as far as the remote viewing data are concerned, and, you know, among the many governments out there that do know about remote viewing, they're not going to question whether this stuff is real or not. They're already way past that. So anyway, so we have sort of two things going on at the same time. We have sort of a public awareness of all of these things, but then we also have governmental awareness worldwide of these things. And we're already past the governmental awareness, which is an interesting thing as well, because it really means that the whole secrecy issue of this whole process, of the whole 9/11 set of events and the remote viewing process, is really history at this point, as far as many governments are concerned. So it's only a matter of time before all of this does come out into the and is fully accepted by mainstream or the mass public, in my opinion.
One thing that struck me watching the sessions was the distinct lack of Arab terrorists coming up.
You know, that was really a major thing. Now, that doesn't mean that there weren't Arab terrorists on those planes. What it means is that they were extremely insignificant in terms of those events, that they were just not major players. It didn't matter what they were. The remote viewers were tasked with looking at the buildings and finding out why they collapsed. You know, so the conclusion to draw out of that is that whatever the Arab terrorists were doing was insignificant. Now, the really interesting thing from one perspective is Osama bin Laden. So if you actually extrapolate from this, he was the biggest fool of them all, because he actually thought his terrorists brought down the buildings. and little did he know that the great enemy that he was fighting was using him to do exactly what he thought he was doing, and he was actually supporting this entire effort that was going on. So he actually was the biggest fool of anyone, to thinking he was attacking the West when in fact the West was using him to as a front man to stage something that they wanted to do anyway. That's what the remote viewing seemed to suggest. And it's also interesting, and I'm widely speculating at this point, I have no data to back this up at all, is that when he was actually captured, it's sort of odd. I mean, they purposefully let him go in Afghanistan in the beginning when they didn't capture him, when they knew where he was, and they said, let the Afghanis or the Pakistanis sort of capture him. And they didn't get him. So they ended up escaping. And then he was around for so many years. And then finally, when he was no longer useful, you see, if he was ever captured early on, then he was the big boogeyman, and the public would not have had that person to hate to sort of spur them on to continue with the war efforts. So if he was captured early on, it would have actually hurt the war efforts. And then when it came to a point where he was no longer useful, he was captured, and movies and hit books came out as well, memorializing or immortalizing that glorious event where the enemy was finally captured. And it makes me wonder if they could have brought him in at any time all along and just kept him around as a, you know, the sort of a public stooge to keep the public agitated about the war effort because of the continued fighting and so on. I mean, I have no data to back that up whatsoever. It's just me wildly speculating. But I wouldn't be surprised at that point if this happened. Now, mind you, in their documentary, I clearly say that remote viewing cannot be used to prove anything. You cannot say something's real simply because you remote viewed it. You have to use remote viewing in combination with the physical evidence. You have to use it as part of the whole thing to piece an entire thing together, like with the court case. And you don't just rely on one piece of evidence. You take eyewitness reports, you take physical evidence, you put it all together, and you build a case for the most likely outcome or the most likely decision, the most likely process by which something may have happened. And so what I'm suggesting is that these remote viewing data are extremely persuasive. Even if they cannot prove anything, they are extremely persuasive just by themselves. And then when you combine them with all the anomalous physical evidence, it really looks clear what happened. And so I'm not suggesting that people take the remote viewing evidence out of context all by themselves and just say this is what happened. What I am suggesting is that they look at the remote viewing data and then look at all the anomalous physical evidence, note that they match, and note that nothing matches with the official story. Sometimes that's called the official government conspiracy theory. So the official government conspiracy theory, or the official story, doesn't match either the physical record, and it certainly doesn't match the remote viewing data. So anyway, I want to emphasize that remote viewing cannot be used independently to prove anything. It's an eyewitness report, but eyewitnesses just by themselves have never been perfect in the courts. So you need eyewitnesses combined with physical evidence, everything tying together, and you literally build a case for something. And in my opinion, the case is strong for the 9/11 events to be a much bigger deal than what was officially reported in the media, and the official story to be incorrect with regard to how it was reported that those buildings and all of the other events actually came down.
Oh, you have instances of eyewitnesses in court completely contradicting each other, and yeah. You have proven cases where, whether it's because of trauma or because of the tension of the situation, an eyewitness who will say, I saw the following, and it categorically did not happen that way, but the eyewitness is completely convinced they did see something, but it wasn't there.
Yeah. Yeah, and they're totally convinced. I mean, totally convinced. And that's one of the reasons that eyewitness reports by themselves are unreliable. And many people have been sent to prison based on eyewitness reports that later turned out to be incorrect. And many people have been on death row and assassinated and, you know, killed, executed by eyewitness reports that were of highly dubious nature. So you can't rely on just eyewitness reports no matter what. You have to look at eyewitness reports. Now, some eyewitness reports are really good and other ones are not so good. And so when you look at remote viewing data, you're looking at eyewitness reports from, you know, from very good, you know, with the best remote viewers, you're dealing with the best eyewitnesses. I mean, these people who are really officially trained to collect their data. In addition, they're collecting their data under totally blind conditions. So they don't have any prejudices involved in this. They're just reporting what they're perceiving, and that's what their expertise, to be perfect eyewitnesses. So in terms of eyewitnesses, they're actually at the very high end of quality. But even still, you then need to compare it with physical data to corroborate. Now, if you get eyewitness reports of whatever quality, but it contradicts the physical evidence, you simply say, well, the eyewitness is not reliable, no matter who it is. So if you get eyewitness reports that do match the physical data and the anomalies associated with the data, then you say, well, that's building a case and looks like that eyewitness report is very highly reliable. Anyway, these guys are the best remote viewers there are, and with these military-derived methodologies. And in my opinion, these eyewitness reports are really valuable, extremely valuable, and they do seem to match closely the anomalous physical evidence.
Well, even though you can look at the events of 9/11, and if you do so, try to come from an unbiased perspective, the whole thing looks like some kind of big David Copperfield style stunt. In what you've just been saying, I think, is the key to why so many, you know, intelligent, good, honest people go along completely with the official narrative, is because in some way it is like a magician's trick. You're being told what you're seeing, and yeah, even though your intuition or your intelligence might tell you something else, the official story is saying, look over here, this is what happened. This is what happened. And of course, people don't want to believe the enormity of the implications of what could be behind this if it were revealed that it was an inside job, a conspiracy. They don't want to think about how the world would change for them, even though it has already happened, you know, for the rest of us, as it were. And I think that's really, really, very powerful. It's like all sorts of programming that you get from, you know, the media and advertising. Mm-hmm. You're basically being told, this is the way things are. Don't you worry about what your five senses tell you. This is it. And that can be very powerful.
Yeah. It's extremely challenging for people to accept that what they're being told by their government may not be correct. It's extremely challenging. And there's a whole 9/11 truther movement whose most common refrain is rethink 9/11, meaning even then they're realizing that just to tell people that what they've been told about 9/11 is wrong, it's so jarring, they're trying to get people to allow into their minds the possibility that everything may not be what they thought. So they're saying rethink 9/11 rather than just sort of say you've been sold a bill of goods. I mean, it's really extremely difficult to take information on such a huge event such as 9/11 and say it was all a fraud. The government has become very good at doing this, however, and this goes all the way back to, say, the Roswell incident, where the government has been able to say anything they want to dismiss any UFO or extraterrestrial sighting, saying anything from swamp gas to a glitch in a photo or whatever, and people accept it, and it's touted by the media, it's reported by the media, it's just, you know, truth. And they become so good, they become cocky at thinking that the public will accept anything we tell them. And so whether it's dealing with the JFK assassination or whether it's dealing with the UFO phenomenon or whatever, the government sort of has it down pat. Tell the people something, make a good story out of it, they'll accept it. And in general, it seems to be working. But this is a case where the evidence really does go contrary, and they may have become too cocky with this one because, well, we'll have to wait and see. I mean, there have been a lot of exposés about other things, and it never got to the point where mainstream media accepts it and reports that the government pulled the wool over their heads, over their eyes. But this may actually turn out to be the one that contradicts everything, because if you're, once you accept that this is, that this actually happened, you realize the magnitude of the sort of false reality that's been painted by official sources over a whole group of subjects, and that's extremely difficult for most people to accept. Anyway, the government's banking on the idea that this will remain a challenge for people and for the media, and thus not become mainstream. However, I can say this much, Greg. There does seem to be a very, very large, significant section in the intelligence community or the military or government that wants this information out. With regard to the UFO extraterrestrial type of stuff, ever since the late 1940s, any time a UFO group started to organize and become somewhat significant, they were always disrupted. Now, I know this from being personally told about this stuff by Intel people, that I know I can't prove it to you. It's considered hearsay because I'm telling you about what other people have told me. The only way you could get it verified in a court of law, if those people actually came forward and gave their names and you could interrogate them directly. So me telling you about what they told me is hearsay, and you can thus throw it out. It would not be accepted in a case of law. Nonetheless, I'm going to say it anyway. I have been, you know, told point blank about the efforts to disrupt these UFO groups all throughout the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, up to the current time period. So, you know, disrupting them was a standard operating procedure. They never wanted any of the groups to grow very large. And many of the mainstream or fringe radio and other venues for sort of bringing this stuff out were, you know, highly sort of, well, some of them were orchestrated. And so with the 9/11 stuff, I don't see any evidence at all of this type of disruption. Meaning you have these pilot groups organizing in large numbers, you have the architects and engineers organizing in large numbers, famous people like Ed Asner, you know, I work with them, help host some of the videos. So, and we have not been disrupted at all. I mean, these agencies, these intelligence agencies and so on, they do have the resources to close any of these groups down at the blink of an eye. I mean, they can disrupt these groups, and including us, and close us down. I mean, they have the ability to do that. They're very clever at what they do, and there's always a method to do it, whether it's through scandal or infiltrating and producing arguments and then having the group splinter. I mean, they're really good at doing this type of stuff. And I have seen no evidence of that happening whatsoever. And the only thing that I can point to that would explain that is that the government is split. So I am under the assumption that half of the government is like royally ticked that the whole 9/11 thing happened. I mean, like royally ticked that the whole 9/11 thing happened. We got, not only did the 9/11 thing happen the way it happened, but we got sent into wars, Afghanistan and New York, I mean, and Iraq, that were unwinnable. I mean, they're still going on, and, you know, the endless wars, and a lot of people died. Now, with regard to the Nazis, for example, in World War II, there's a lot of good evidence to indicate that Franklin Delano Roosevelt definitely wanted to enter the war in Europe to defeat the Nazis, to help defeat the Nazis, but didn't want to do that until the American public were totally behind him. He didn't want to enter World War II like Woodrow Wilson entered World War I, where we had to fight internal opponents just as much as he was fighting the on the battlefield. So Roosevelt, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, was waiting for an incident to occur in the Pacific. And that's been heavily reported by people like Turner Catledge, former editor-in-chief of the New York Times, who was a very close confidant of Roosevelt, who stated point blank on video that you can actually see on YouTube now, that Roosevelt was waiting for the incident to occur in the Pacific, despite Churchill's pleas, enter the war now, we're being bombed, this is going crazy, you have to help us, enter the war. And so they took that time while they were waiting for the incident to happen in the Pacific, which turned out to be Pearl Harbor. They waited, while they were waiting for that, they transformed the American economy into a wartime economy. So instead of building cars and so on, they were building tanks and bullets and guns and so on, and shipping that over. But constantly Roosevelt was saying, but we will not send humans, Americans, to fight these wars. We will give them the means to fight their own wars with our and economic support, but we will not send our own troops. And then World War, and then of course Pearl Harbor happened, and Roosevelt looks shocked and saying, oh my gosh, this is a day of infamy, a day that will live in infamy, and so on. And then there was no more opposition. And the opposition before that was very significant, which included famous people like Joseph Kennedy, former U.S. ambassador to Britain, who was actually quite anti-British. And so, you know, having a Pearl Harbor type of attack was sort of justifiable. And I'm not saying that Roosevelt knew the details of Pearl Harbor, but he knew that there was going to be a major incident in the Pacific. Whether or not he knew the details of Pearl Harbor, I'm just not going to go into that. But it was very clear that they knew that there was going to be a major incident in the Pacific involving the Japanese Navy, and they were going to have to wait for it to occur before committing themselves to war going to Europe. And so now you compare that with 9/11. You see, with the Nazis, you had to fight. That was essentially a holy war. You had to fight that. You're fighting the Nazis, for heaven's sake. They were not only going to conquer all of Europe, but they would have had atomic weaponry within, you know, a few years, and they would have attacked and conquered us, the United States. I mean, you had to fight the Nazis. There's no question about it. So whether or not Roosevelt knew about the Pearl Harbor incident in advance, whether or not he knew that there was going to be an incident in the Pacific, it doesn't matter. It was necessary in order to mobilize the force. It was a trick, but it was necessary in order to mobilize the country to fight a real enemy that was going to threaten our very survival. You can't say that with Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. They were a bunch of jerks, and that could have been snuffed out. So those wars, Iraq and Afghanistan, were essentially insignificant. We didn't win those wars. They're still going on, and they're going to drag on forever. And Iraq looked like it's eventually going to just be broken up into three separate states, Kurdistan and a Shiite and then a Sunni
Well, back
section.
To what it was before it was artificially before stuck was, together.
Yeah, it looks like. And you can sort of say, well, why did we do this? And so the fact that we've not been stopped to come out with this documentary, and the fact that the other groups have not been disrupted or stopped, indicates to me that a huge portion of the American government is fully aware of everything that happened and royally ticked, royally upset. And they're protecting us. They're not letting us be disrupted. That's the only conclusion I can draw from it, because the disrupting elements of the intelligence organizations are really, really, they're really good, Greg. I mean, what they do, what they want you to believe is that they're not nearly capable of doing things so you can say, nah, they would never do that. That's what they want you to believe. The reality is they're capable of doing almost anything. They're really, really good. I've never been so impressed by people as with the intelligence people when you get to know who they are and what they're doing. They can do almost anything. They can pull a rabbit out of a hat. I mean, they're really, really, really good, not just at just disrupting groups, but getting all types of stuff done. And it's my belief that a good, hefty portion of them are really upset with what happened in 9/11. It was not a Pearl Harbor event. It was not supposed to, I mean, it wasn't, there was no justification for that type of a thing. Pearl Harbor, if it was allowed to happen, even I would not complain about it. I said, hey, you know, we needed to get into the war. And if Pearl Harbor got us into the war and got rid of internal opposition and so that we could actually do it, who am I to question Franklin Delano Roosevelt? I mean, that's the way Turner Catledge, former editor-in-chief of the New York Times, that's how he described it. You can see it on YouTube. So when you think about 9/11, you have to ask yourself, is the situation comparable to the Nazis? I don't think so, in my opinion. And yeah. I think a good portion of the government feels the same way. Otherwise, I wouldn't be talking on your show.
Well, talking about Pearl Harbor, but to also, we mentioned earlier, obviously the JFK assassination. With regards to 9/11, I've often wondered what it would take for it actually to go mainstream, to go public, to actually be admitted and say, okay, this is what happened. Now we're going to move on. You know, because I look at, you know, a kid born on 9/11 is what, like 13 years old now. And I've got some friends who've got kids who are that age and younger. And for them, 9/11 is just something that happened. It's almost like it doesn't matter. Whereas to you and I, I don't know about you personally, but I can look at it and see it as the by far the biggest, most world-changing event that's ever taken place during my lifetime.
Yeah. You see, if the remote viewing evidence, which is the only evidence out there right now that ties it all together, before that, you only have forensic evidence. A lot of really good forensic evidence done by really competent people, but the remote viewing evidence is the only eyewitness reports that sort of tie all together and connect all the dots and explain who did what, where, and how. When that happens, because if you don't have that, if you don't have the remote viewing evidence, you're going to have confessions. And I don't think you're going to get those confessions. You'd have to have top-level governmental people come up and say, yeah, I did that. And I don't think that's ever going to happen. So to get to the level of widespread mainstream acceptance, you're going to have to get to the level of accepting the remote viewing evidence, because that's the only place that the whole story has been shown. And when that happens, it will generate a house of cards collapse that's much bigger than 9/11. You're talking about a complete restructuring of the course materials that are taught at the universities. Not with regard to science and the nature of physical reality and physics departments, but you're also talking about restructuring social science programs, talking about civilizations on Earth, anthropology, archaeological stuff. Ancient civilizations go way past 3,000 years ago. You're talking about a whole new stuff dealing with extraterrestrial phenomena. You're talking about so many things. In fact, sometimes I wake up in the morning, go take a shower, and while I'm getting out of the shower, I just sort of think, you know, this whole world is like an insane asylum. There's more that people believe that's crazy than what they believe that's correct. I mean, the beliefs are so deep. I mean, the general mainstream beliefs are, we are a new civilization that popped out of a monkey just a few hundred thousand years ago, and our mainstream, our mainstream sort of modern civilization is only 3,000 years old, and before that, humans never did anything. That no other extraterrestrials exist, that we're alone in the universe all by ourselves, that the government doesn't lie to us, that they told us the truth with respect to extraterrestrials, they told us the truth with respect to 9/11, they told us the truth with respect to all sorts of stuff, we can just take it at face value. And whenever anyone says, nah, they would never do that, they're giving those people permission to do exactly that. As soon as you say, no, the government would never do that, you've given the government permission to do it, because they know that you're not going to call them on the table. You've said you're not going to believe that they did something, so they have the ability to do it. As long as you believe that they won't do it, they can do it. So, you know, it's not just when will the 9/11 stuff come out. When the 9/11 stuff hits mainstream, it will cascade into a whole host of other things. And I am of the absolute knowledge, it's not just belief, total belief, just total knowledge, and sort of as an accepted truth, that our civilization will not come to an end just because we do that. There will be a major restructuring of thinking. But in terms of galactic scale, it'll be one heck of a fun time. It'll be really an interesting psychological event. It'll be way better than going to see the best movie in the world. I mean, it will be entertaining plus. But, you know, we're not going to fall out of the sky. It's not the end of the world. It's not like the end of civilization as we know it. It will be, on galactic terms, very rare, very unusual. But it's not going to kill us. And so I'm really looking forward to, in my lifetime, seeing that happen. Because I think there's too much happening to avoid that from happening in the relatively near future. No, I'm not talking about a week from now or a year from now, but within a, you know, I think certainly by 2025, I think all of this stuff, including the extraterrestrial stuff, will be as commonplace knowledge as, you know, what kind of foods are available in different parts of the world. I mean, it'll just be commonplace knowledge. And we're really not talking that long a time. We're talking 10, 11 years before it's really totally widespread and accepted. And probably by around that time, you'll have open interactions between some ETs, some extraterrestrials, and humans. So you'll have some type of, you know, reality that's sort of connecting people in real time. I think major revelations with respect to all types of... See, the thing is that the remote viewing stuff, once you go down that road of accepting even the smallest piece of remote viewing thing is real, it's like the finger that was holding the dike back, and you pull the dike out, you pull the finger out, and the whole dike collapsed. So you're going to get sort of a cascade of stuff happening. And I don't think we're very far away from that. And as much as some people may fear it, I'm absolutely certain nothing is going to come out of it other than just, you know, a lot of people talking. But it's not going to be the end of civilization. It's not going to be the end of the world. It'll be a major change, but no one's going to die from it, and it's going to be really exciting when it actually happens.
Well, it's like whenever it was revealed that the Earth wasn't flat after all, or that
the sun
didn't revolve around the Earth, you know, that wasn't the end of civilization moment.
I know, but they thought it was. They thought, you know, if you acknowledge that the Earth is not flat, that's like terrible. I mean, when Galileo came up with his stuff and said, you know, Copernicus was correct and Earth is not orbiting the sun, it's the reverse. We're orbiting the sun and the other planets are orbiting the sun. Well, they actually thought that was going to be the end of civilization. Now, I have heard people say, no, Courtney, you know, what would have happened was people would have killed each other. There would have really been fighting. There would have been death, shooting. I've heard people argue that. So they kept him in house arrest for 8 years or gave him the option of dying, one of the two, and he chose house arrest. But, you know, the question is, what would have happened had it happened quickly, if they just sort of acknowledged he was correct? Well, there might have been some tumult, but it would not have been anywhere near the fear that the authorities had of what would have happened. So it's usually the fear of what they think is going to happen that drives them to their great lengths of trying to stop information from coming out, not the reality of what's going to actually happen. Anyway, we're so far beyond that at this point. So many people in the world accept the things that are being discovered and revealed by remote viewing that we're way past the point of even there being a significant threat of the, you know, end of civilization type stuff.
Well, just in closing, Courtney, I think for me, since I first discovered remote viewing, the most exciting thing about it all has been the understanding that basically time doesn't exist, or that time and space are not what we think they are, that everything that has been and possibly everything that ever will be is sort of accessible, that events that are in the past are not gone. That they're still alive. Yeah. And
well, this is the new physics that I was talking about. So when you look at quantum mechanics and relativistic physics, you're dealing with stuff that was basically discovered in their fundamentals over 100 years ago. So it's very dated. So the stuff we're taught in the university is very, very, very dated now. Now, a lot of details have changed. A lot of advancement has occurred in terms of applications. We do quantum computing and things like that. But the fundamentals are old. Really old. And so what we're talking about is a completely new level of physics. And the only way they can keep that facade up of thinking that this is the real stuff with quantum mechanics and relativistic physics, sort of the end of the story, is by disallowing facts, disallowing all types of phenomena that don't fit those theories. So you get a lot of mainstream physicists simply not wanting and saying, we don't look at that. We don't do that. We will not look at this. We don't examine that. This is not real. And they call it names, pseudoscience, whatever they want to do to try to diminish it. But what they're doing is putting an intellectual barricade against certain facts that if even one of those facts is allowed in, it just completely collapses the entire intellectual infrastructure that they're working on. So, yeah, it's we're talking about a complete new level of physics. And even people like Michio Kaku has talked about almost an inevitability of a complete new level of physics eventually entering, where everything that we now use to describe the reality that we have is relegated to a small subset of what we eventually understand. Meaning, I'm going way beyond Michio Kaku now, that what we look at now with relativistic and quantum mechanics is a small subset of a greater reality, and it's a sandbox. You're sort of describing what goes on in that sandbox, and within that sandbox those rules fit and they work. But as soon as you accept other things that are occurring outside of the sandbox, those rules don't work at all. And so you have to say, well, then what are more general principles that would allow not only the stuff in the sandbox to be explained, but also the stuff that's being excluded from examination that's outside of the sandbox? And that's a completely new realm of physics. That's a much more general set of explanations for the nature of physical reality. And we're not there yet in terms of the mainstream, but people who are following what we do with remote viewing, we are clearly showing the evidence that that sandbox is very limited and that there is a much greater reality out there. And yes, the past, present, and the future do exist at the same time. Everything is simultaneous, that there is nothing, there's nothing that's gone simply because it's in the past. It's not just that it's accessible, but it's still there. And so that's, you know, that's again a whole new realm of physics that we're getting to. I did give a talk about that in Boulder, Colorado, home of the University of Colorado, a few years back, and that's available on our website at farsight.org, www.farsight.org, right on the homepage. And that video is actually the video of the talk dealing with this new science is called Remote Viewing and Quantum Science, and again, University of Colorado at Boulder. And so it's a very interesting talk, and it's 21 minutes long, and it's free on YouTube. So if those people are interested in it, that's a nice thing to do. And while you're at the Farsight Institute's website, farsight.org, two things. Subscribe to our free newsletter. We're a nonprofit, so we don't have a way to advertise. So that's the only way you get to know about what we're doing. So just put in your email address. We don't give out the email addresses for any purpose whatsoever. And it's just to send out our free newsletter and take a look at the trailer for the Remote Viewing 9/11 project. It's really great, and it's the most exciting project we've done so far.
And also for listeners who haven't already done so, if they are on legalizedfreedom.com, they will find previous interviews with you about your previous projects. There's one on the Great Pyramid, Giza. There's one on Atlantis. And there's also an introductory talk that we did which concerns remote viewing itself. So for people who are completely new to this, that's a really good starting point.
Yeah, and Greg, I want to thank you so much for inviting me on your show. It's really a pleasure always.
Well, all I can say in closing is, Courtney, just thanks so much for joining us yet again on LegalizedFreedom.com.
Well, folks, that's it for another week. As ever, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy the show, please check out the website. That's LegalizedFreedom.com. legalized-freedom.com, where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics, including world affairs, politics and economics, science and technology, religion and spirituality, conspiracy, and alternative history. You can also browse and buy a range of books and DVDs from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to legalizedfreedom.com.